how many ed checks I sent out over the years that I never even heard back about. I didn't consider quitting for a second. I always knew I was going to find my way on my own. I didn't partake in any secret Illuminati initiation ceremony where I had to sacrifice a hamster in front of Jay-Z, Beyonce, Kanye, and Rihanna. Nor was I sworn into a secret cabal of gay music executives. If you believe in that sort of shit, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what else to tell you. But just know that while you're making excuses about your favorite artist's success, someone else is out there putting the weed in the bag and creating opportunities for themselves. Get in where you fit in. A final word on interns. A crucial mistake a lot of them make is worrying about the specific branch or department of an organization their internship is in. I saw this recently when an intern named Sage came to me for advice as her time at Powell was winding down. She'd worked hard, was reliable, and had managed to build strong relationships with the staff. People wanted to help her. There was a job opening up in Powell's promotions department, and several staffers said they would recommend her. Perfect setup, right? But Sage told me she was apprehensive about the gig. Promotions isn't what I really want to do, she explained. I'm really more interested in being an on-air jock or a producer. You're going about this entirely the wrong way, I told her. You should have one goal: get in the building. Or in your case, stay in the building. If that means taking a job in promotions, take the job in promotions. If that means taking a job in sales, take the job in sales. If it means being the receptionist, be the receptionist. Who cares if those aren't your dream jobs? Fuck your dreams. Your reality is you need to be in this building. Once you're here, you can use that access to start hanging around the studios. You can build relationships with the jocks and producers. You can find ways of making yourself useful, even if it's not part of your job description. Eventually, that hustle will pay off. Sage understood the value in what I was saying and took the job. It only paid her 10 or 11 bucks an hour, but once she was in the building, she made a point of stopping by and visiting her old friends at the Breakfast Club every day. A few months later, Envy decided he needed an assistant, saw Sage, and gave her the job. Then when he decided to start the Casey Crew podcast with his wife Gia, he needed a producer and gave that job to Sage too. So even though she isn't officially producing and working with talent, just by keeping her foothold in the building, she ended up with the experience she was looking for. Sage's situation is a great example of the value of just getting your foot in the door. But I still see narrow-minded attitudes in interns time and time again. If a position isn't exactly what they want, then they're not interested. So please, if you're up for an internship or really an entry-level position in a company, do not get hung up on what department your opportunity comes in. If you're willing to put in that hard work I've been talking about, then every job in an organization you want to be in should be viewed as a golden opportunity. 168 hours. One indicator I use to tell whether someone is built for success is their attitude toward time management. Time is something that you can't fight or try to escape. If it takes an hour to get somewhere, stop trying to get there in 45 minutes. It pisses me off when I hear people say they don't have enough time. I was once tweeting about the value of internships, and this young woman hit me back to say, "I work 40 hours a week. How am I supposed to have time for an unpaid internship on top of that?" I know a lot of young people feel that way, so I had to break it down for her mathematically. There are 168 hours in a week total. Let's say you work 40 hours a week at a job, and then you're in school for another 40 hours. That still leaves you with another 80-plus hours. Those additional hours are more than enough time to deal with your reality, pursue your passions, and get the most important thing, which is some damn sleep. Sleep is the one area you simply can't cut corners. I got gassed up too back in the day when I heard Nas rap, "I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death." I spent too much of my 20s thinking, damn, if I'm sleeping, I must be slacking. But now I know better. If anything, a lack of sleep is what's gonna kill you. The truth is, unless you're an artist in a creative groove that you just don't want to break, there's not a lot of legit business being conducted at 4 a.m. Sorry, for everyone working 9 to 5 hours, you need rest to be effective. I was always told when you sleep, God does maintenance on your soul. And when you get a good night's rest, it damn sure feels that way. You feel refreshed physically and spiritually. Another great thing about getting a good night's sleep is it helps you retain information. One of my favorite things to do before bed is to read something uplifting in a book, maybe some Bible scriptures, passages in the Quran, Don Miguel Ruiz's books on Toltec wisdom, or Jennifer Lopez's Instagram. I try to end my day with positive information that can settle my mind as I sleep and then really stick in my brain. So let's say you sleep at least 6 hours a night or 42 hours a week. That still leaves you another 40-plus hours that could be spent pursuing your passion. I can hear some of you now. Well, what about my social life? What about my time with friends? Fuck your social life. Fuck your friends. And while I'm at it, fuck your feelings, too. If that's what's important to you, then spend time with your friends. But don't expect to be successful, because if you're truly passionate about your career, then that's where you need to dedicate those extra hours. If the folks you want to hang out with are really your friends, they will understand and support you. I remember when I was trying to juggle night school, working a day job, and putting in time in the streets. I might have been misguided, but at least I took the streets seriously. I always made sure I never skipped school. At the time, I was hanging with my homie Joe, who was deep in the drug game and would go on to become a huge kingpin before being busted on federal charges. One time, Joe told me, "Man, I fuck with you because you're focused. No matter what we doing out here, you still take your ass to school. That's some real shit." See, like I said, real friends, even those who sell crack, will understand. After I finally gave up the street life, I still needed to make money while I was interning at Jams. I was determined to do it legally, so I started working odd jobs around Mount's Corner. First, I worked in a warehouse called Industrial Acoustics Company, loading and unloading trucks. Then I worked at a telemarketing company called Paragon Solutions, where we hustled CDs for BMG Music Group. Their tagline was 10 CDs for the price of half, which basically meant that after shipping, you'd get 10 discs for 27 bucks. Not a bad deal. The toughest gig I had during that period was at the Carolina Nursery, a.k.a. the Flower Garden, which was a Mount's Corner institution for years before it shut down. The Flower Garden housed over 600 acres of plants and garden supplies, and they would hire anyone to lug bags of soil and potted plants around the premises. Flower Garden was a place where you went when you couldn't get a job anywhere else. When I worked there, it was nothing but Mexican guys and a couple of older black dudes. I didn't last long. One day they assigned me to move soil to a part of the facility that was right next to a bus stop. I was out there sweating in the sun, covered in dirt, when a school bus pulled up with a bunch of kids I knew on it. They all started pointing at me and cracking up. I couldn't take the public ridicule, so I moved on to other jobs. At one point, my sister Teresa got me a job at the Taco Bell she was the manager at. I thought I could mess around because of her position, but my sister wasn't having it. After watching me BS for a couple weeks, she fired me. I also worked in the local mall in an urban clothing store called Demo, where I tried to sell the latest and cheaply produced garments from companies like Aniche, FUBU, Fat Farm, and Rockaware. It wasn't easy dragging soil around and stacking boxes all day and then heading to the radio till the middle of the night, but I was more than happy to do it. If I could make legal money and pursue my radio dreams at the same time, then I was going to pack as much into those 168 hours as possible. For everyone who thinks that what I'm suggesting might sound extreme, it's still the life I live every day. Here's what my schedule looks like. Every weekday, I wake up at 3:45 a.m. and give God a little prayer of thanks for blessing me with another day. After I take a shower, my longtime friend, more like my brother, Wax, picks me up in Jersey. A word about Wax, who is already familiar to fans of the Brilliant Idiots and Uncommon Sense. I've known Wax since 2002, when he was playing football for Allen University in Columbia. I had a side hustle selling mixtapes of East Coast artists like Dipset and G-Unit. Wax was from Jersey, so of course he became a steady customer. After that, we just clicked, and whether I was on the radio or out at the club, Wax and our boy Dre would roll with me everywhere. It's been like that for the past 15 years, which is why it's funny when people say, "Charlamagne be with security." I wouldn't call Wax security. He's my family, who just happens to be 6'4 and 240 pounds of solid muscle and will knock your head clear off your shoulders. After about a half-hour drive, we make it to Power Studio in Manhattan by 5 a.m. to prep for the show. Every day we're live on air till 10 a.m., after which we'll tape additional interviews till about noon for the following day's show. For those of you keeping score, that's already a 7-hour workday right there. Depending on which day of the week it is, after wrapping up at Power, I'll either head over to MTV to tape one of my shows with them or to another studio to tape my podcast, The Brilliant Idiots. After I'm done taping those, I'll take meetings with the agents, producers, and writers who are working on the various projects I've got cooking. On a good day, I'll be able to leave the city by 3 or 4 so I can spend some time with my daughters and catch up with my wife. Then I go to the gym to get a workout in, since physical fitness is non-negotiable. I'm back in the crib by 8, grab another shower, and then spend some more time with the kids before they go to bed. Once they're tucked in, I'll jump on social media and see if there's any good content for the next day's show, which there always is. After that, it's time for some positive reading, and then in bed by 11. That means at least four times a week, I'll put in a 15 to 17-hour workday. And I cherish every single second of those hours. I know all too well what it feels like to be unemployed or shut out from what you want to be doing. I worked at Taco Bell and a flower garden. I sold crack. What I'm doing now isn't work to me. What's that saying? If you love what you do, you will never work a day in your life. I can vouch that the saying is 100% the truth. Notice that I didn't allocate any time in my schedule for socializing or just hanging out. I'd say out of my week, 95% of my waking hours are spent either working on my career or with my wife and kids. I wouldn't have it any other way. The question is, are you willing to put in those kind of 15-hour days if it means getting closer to your dreams? Are you willing to get up at 3:45 a.m. and go to bed at 11 p.m. 5 days a week? If you're in school, are you prepared to study from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. every day and then go to work and then head to your internship at 3 p.m.? Or do you need more time for yourself? Do you need more time to play video games, to text with your friends, to mess around on social media? Choose to do what you want with your time, but just understand you have to live with the consequences of those actions. No matter how you spend the next 10 years of your life, you do not get a redo. If it makes your decision easier, I can tell you that socializing and me time is not what the other successful people I know choose. They always choose a lifestyle that allows them to get in the most work possible. I'm talking about people like Ryan Seacrest, Steve Harvey, and Bobby Bones. Folks who put in more work by 10 a.m. than most people do all day. Who are squeezing everything they can out of those 168 hours. Radio shows, TV shows, podcasts, books, movies. They're not passing up any opportunities. Those are the examples that inspire me when I feel like I'm running out of gas a bit. I tell myself, Ryan Seacrest is out there in a meeting somewhere right now getting more paper. I can make it to my meeting too. I know Steve is probably taping his second TV show of the day right now. I can hang out on this set for another hour until we nail this final take. Bobby Bones is like my radio brother, a great friend. And we talk all the time about how we are next in line for the throne Steve and Ryan currently sit in. So I know Bobby is working his ass off, whether it's his syndicated radio show, The Bobby Bones Show, touring with his band, The Raging Idiots, editing his latest book, or producing a TV show. I know he's not wasting a minute. And unlike me, he doesn't have a wife and kids. It's just him and his dog. So right there, he's got an advantage. And I've got to work even harder if I'm going to keep up. Of course, just saying you're going to make the most of your week isn't enough. To do it, you're going to have to develop some real discipline in your day-to-day schedule. First, you have to say goodbye to the smoking and drinking if that's part of your lifestyle. That's right, the kid who used to smoke weed like Red and Meth's little brother hasn't had a puff in God knows how long. Sure, if I'm down in Anguilla, my favorite vacation spot, I might take a few drags off a joint. When I do, I always hear Jay-Z's verse in my head. Okay, I'm getting weeded now. I know I'm contradicting myself. Look, I don't need that now. It's just once in a blue when there's nothing to do. The key words in that verse are, once in a blue when there's nothing to do. If you're smoking more than every once in a blue moon, you're smoking too much. You have to view weed as a treat, not an everyday thing. I used to smoke every day, and it wasn't getting me where I wanted to go. The only place it got me was being around a bunch of dudes who were more interested in getting high than making moves. Sure, we had some funny moments that I always remember, but like Jay said, I don't need that now. I have a similar relationship with alcohol. Yes, I'll still sip a little Remy Martin when I'm back in Mons Corner on vacation or during a special occasion in New York, but drinking on a normal weeknight? Out of the question. I'm not straight edge. I got a full bar in the crib, but I'm never tempted by it because I'm buzzed off the work I'm putting in. Not to mention, drinking takes too much of a toll on you physically, especially when you've got to be up at 3:45 every morning. I'd be out of gas and ready to go home by noon every day if I'd been drinking the night before. That would mean literally half my career would be off the table. I learned that the hard way. Back in 2011, I went on a two-week run of being out in the clubs every night. I was drinking, smoking, not watching what I ate, and not getting enough sleep. One morning, I was in the Breakfast Club studios, and I didn't feel right. I tried to lie down between breaks, but I could tell it was more than just being tired or hungover. A voice in my head told me to go to the hospital, so I checked myself into the emergency room. Come to find out, I was seriously dehydrated. I used to read about celebrities getting sent to the hospital for dehydration and assume it was cold for something else, most likely drugs. Nope, trust me, dehydration is real, and it's no joke. I felt like I was gonna die. Ludacris wasn't lying in his song, Catch Up. All this drinking, gonna catch up, and all this smoking, gonna catch up. But some niggas just really don't give a fuck. It definitely caught up with me. But that was one situation where I did give a fuck. So much so that I vowed to wean smoking and drinking out of my lifestyle after that. Another big adjustment I had to make was eating better. For most of my life, I was on a diet of Chick-fil-A, Bojangles, Pizza Hut, McDonald's, and sodas. The garbage that tasted good when you're a teenager ruins us in the long term. I didn't think it was affecting me that much, but boy, was I wrong. It got me to a point where I literally had to fix my face. A few years ago, I was at a party in Manhattan when a woman approached me and said, "I can do something about that, you know," in a British accent. "What are you talking about?" I asked. "Those dark spots on your face," she replied. "I can help you get rid of them." I don't know if you've seen pictures of me from earlier in my career, but I absolutely used to have crazy dark patches on my face, especially below my eyes. I remember the comedian Marlon Wayans once said I looked like a bruised eggplant, and I can't say he was wrong. I developed them as a teenager, and my pops figured they were from smoking crack. "Look at your face. You got them black spots under your eyes," he yelled. "You must be on that shit." I wasn't smoking crack, but I didn't know what was causing the discoloration, nor did I bother to find out. The spots weren't stopping me from getting girls, which is all that matters to a teenage boy. Still, when the woman said she could get rid of them, I said, "Hey, why not give it a shot?" It turns out she was a dermatologist named Dr. Natasha Sandy, and she suggested I come in for a consultation. I was game and went to her office, where I told her from the jump, "I don't know how you plan to get rid of these, but I'm not doing no bleaching." I only mentioned that because once Dr. Sandy did get those spots off, the internet decided that I had pulled a Sammy Sosa and bleached my skin. It was hilarious to me. The one thing everybody accuses me of doing is the one thing I was adamant I wasn't going to do. That's the internet for you. It turned out it wasn't even an option. As Dr. Sandy explained, that the dark patches weren't a skin condition unto themselves, but rather a symptom of my shitty diet. She promised that if I started eating cleaner, no fried foods, sodas, white breads, and other heavily processed foods, the patches would start to clear up. She prescribed pills to get the inflammation out of my face, gave me chemical pills, acne pads, and complexion correction pads. God, Jewel, if you're trying to lose weight, it all comes down to diet. I've worked out for years, but no amount of bench press will offset working out and then going to Chick-fil-A after the gym. So now I eat vegetables or something green with every meal, whether it's spinach with an omelet, salad at lunch, or asparagus at dinner. I also snack in between meals, protein bars, peanuts, and fruit. Finally, I don't eat after 9 if I can help it. It's all about discipline. That's the biggest part of any process, patience and discipline. Nothing happens overnight. It all added up to a major transformation. In addition to cutting out processed foods, Dr. Sandy also had me start eating 4 to 5 times a day to speed up my metabolism. I ended up losing close to 30 pounds. When I first saw Dr. Sandy, I was 202. Today, I float around in the 170 to 175 pound range. For the first time in my life, I have abs. I'm glad I came to the realization that I didn't want to be one of those people who treat their material possessions better than they treat their own bodies. I know plenty of folks who will refuse to put anything other than premium gas in their car, but are more than happy to put any old type of fast food down their throats, who will clean their Jordans by hand with a toothbrush but won't put nearly the same amount of care into their health. Do I miss some of the foods I used to enjoy, like chicken wings and burgers? Of course. But when you start eating healthy, after just a few weeks, you don't want the garbage anymore. You realize that eating trash foods makes you feel like trash. Are there a couple times a month that I'll cheat and wolf down some barbecue or a pizza? Sure. But then I get right back on my healthy shit. Because I know if I ever go back to eating trash full time, I'm going to start looking and feeling like trash again too. And then I'll never have the energy and the focus to get to everything I want to accomplish. That sort of sacrifice is why I get a little insulted when people say I bleach my skin. I had to work hard to transform myself from a potentially pudgy dude with dark patches under his eyes to a healthy-looking guy with abs. How dare you say I achieved that by taking a couple pills? Nope, it's not that easy. Just like I find it insulting when people say I must have joined the Illuminati or be gay to achieve my success. Trust me, if all you had to do to be Will Smith was give an old movie exec a blowjob, there would be a lot of Will Smiths running around out here. Unless, of course, Will's head is just that fire. But there aren't. Because success like the kind Will has enjoyed only comes through putting in thousands and thousands of hours worth of work and sacrifice. Whether it's becoming a movie star, transforming into a healthier lifestyle, or simply getting the most out of an internship, no matter what you're trying to accomplish in life, it always comes down to this. You must put the weed in the bag. Principle 6. Live your truth. Always live your truth. That way no one can use your truth against you. When you are completely honest about yourself and with yourself, you give zero fucks about anything anyone has to say about you. People can slander you all day, but no judgment or opinion formed against you shall prosper when you live your truth. I've never been comfortable with those who are loose with the truth, or even worse, are straight-up liars. When I was a kid, my father would tell me, when you tell one lie, you're always going to have to tell another one to keep it up, over and over again until it was beaten to my head. Better to tell the truth and deal with the consequences right away. Truth is like the sun. You can shut it out for a time, but it ain't going away. Elvis Presley. Though, to quote the great Chuck D, motherfuck him and John Wayne. No matter how stupid something I have said is, no matter how asinine I've acted, and no matter what sort of stunt I've pulled, I'm going to own it. I won't run from it. Trying to moonwalk past the truth doesn't change reality. There was one time I lost sight of this truth, and it cost me dearly. When the cops first pulled us in for the shooting incident, I panicked and decided to try to lie my way out of the situation, as if a 16-year-old kid could outsmart a police department. The cops asked me to write down a statement about what had happened, and I proceeded to compose my greatest work of fiction to date. It started with me hitchhiking and getting picked up by a bunch of strangers in a red car. I claimed they drove me around for a couple of hours, smoking weed and drinking beer, then without warning, opened fire on the kids in the Jeep. After the shooting, I said I asked to be let out of the car, and they dropped me off on a highway not far from Mount's Corner. Before letting me go, they promised they'd come back and kill me if I told the police what I'd seen, which is why I hadn't reported anything. The story didn't even remotely begin to add up, but the cops still did their due diligence and explored the phony leads I'd given them. A few hours later, they came back to the station supremely pissed off. You know what? We were going to let you go today for talking with us, one of the cops told me. We were going to tell the judge to give you a bond, but since you sent us on a wild goose chase and wasted our time, now you're going to sit. So I sat and sat and sat. I ended up having a few months to reflect on why my father was right. Honesty is always the best policy. When you are completely honest about yourself, there's very little people can say about you that's going to have a negative impact. It's hard for a person to slander you about something you've already revealed to the world. As I like to say, no judgment or opinion formed against you shall prosper when you live your truth. Remember, there's no moment or situation you're ever going to encounter where honesty isn't the best policy. Just got pulled in by the cops? Tell them the truth because they're going to figure it out anyway. Busted stepping out on your wife? And when I say busted, I don't mean she thinks you're sleeping with someone. I mean busted like you're caught butt naked in the pussy. Tell her why you did it. Because you have a dick. And salvage the relationship, if you want to. Own what you did and let the chips fall where they may. You might be surprised that they actually fall in your favor. Honesty is such a rare commodity these days that when you do tell someone the truth when they were expecting a lie, you'll catch them off guard. They might even be willing to look past transgressions that might have otherwise seemed unforgivable. People are thirsty for the truth. Sate that thirst. And they should always appreciate you. But before you can reap the benefits of being honest with other people, you have to learn to be honest with yourself first. The big-nosed idiot. Word is I'm ugly. Maybe I am, but the truth is I've never felt that way about myself. I've always overachieved in the pussy department, so any so-called lack of looks never got under my discolored skin. Still, I've been hearing it long enough that there must be something about the way I look that offends some of y'all. The first time people started making fun of my looks was back in middle school when they began calling me Boonky Nose. Now, for those of you uninitiated in Southern slang, a boonky is a butt. So a boonky nose is a nose that looks like a big ass. Evidently mine did, because that's what girls would say when I walked down the hallways at school. Hey, there go Boonky Nose, they'd shout. What up, Boonky Nose? Even then, that sort of teasing normally wouldn't have bothered me too bad, but it happened to trigger a very shitty experience from back in elementary school that had left me wondering whether in fact there was something wrong with my nose. I was molested by my cousin's ex-wife when I was around 8 years old. I should call her out by name, but I won't, so let's call her Linda. She was probably in her late 20s or early 30s at the time and was supposed to be watching me after school when my grandmother wasn't around. All Linda needed to do was feed me snacks and make sure I didn't get into any trouble, but for whatever twisted reasons, she added making me suck her titties and giving me head to our activity list. I can't say I was traumatized by the sex because the truth is I liked it. When she told me, if you tell a soul about this, I'll never let you do it again, I damn sure kept my mouth shut, but clearly this wasn't a healthy situation. The abuse, even if I liked it, it was still abuse, went on for close to a year and probably would have lasted longer, but one afternoon, Linda showed up in my grandma's place with a brand new Jerry Curl. A Jerry Curl's got to be one of the top three stupidest hairstyles of all time. I don't know whose culture black people were appropriating back then, but not only did those Jerry Curls look stupid and smell terrible, they were also a fire hazard. You would think after Michael Jackson's curl went up in flames, people would learn their lessons, but nope, niggas had to have that drip. Kids, if you still don't know what a Jerry Curl is, see Eazy-E's character in Straight Outta Compton. The smell from the chemical relaxer almost made me gag. I tried to get past it, but it was too much. Suddenly, I wasn't interested in her titties anymore. I guess smell is the strongest sense than sex for young boys. I did everything I could to keep her away from me. Remember those little poppers you got from the fireworks stand that looked like sperm and made a bang when you threw them on the sidewalk? I hated the smell of that Jerry Curl activator so much that I'd throw those poppers at her when she tried to molest me. After a while, Linda got tired of me fighting her off and accepted our inappropriate affair was over. But instead of handling it like an adult, surprise, this grown-ass lady became vindictive. I guess she felt rejected by my 8-year-old self, so she went out of her way to make me feel bad about myself, too. She started saying things like, "Damn, Nard, you got a big-ass nose." Or, "Nard, why your nose so big? Your cousin's noses ain't big like that." Again, this was a grown-ass woman talking to an 8-year-old boy. Of course it got into my head. I wasn't sure what to do, so I went to my grandmother and begged her, "You have to help me do something about my nose." Like all grandmothers, she wanted to help, so she started rubbing cream on my nose every day, claiming it would shrink it. It could have been Preparation H for all I know, but whatever it was, of course it didn't work. How could it have? There was nothing wrong with my nose in the first place. I was just a kid growing into my body who happened to have a big nose. Once all the girls started calling me Boonky Nose, it was fair game for the guys to clown me too. First, I was Toucan Sam. Then they started calling me Ban, or Big Ass Nose. It got so common that I remember I got stuck in remedial math class with this slow kid everyone called Peter Pan. I have no idea what the kid's real name was. We called him Peter Pan because he was obsessed with, you guessed it, Peter Pan. Kids would go up to him and say, "Hey, Peter Pan is dead." Then he would go crazy and chase them around yelling, "Peter Pan is not dead, he's alive!" As I've said, there's not much to do in Mom's Corner. One day I was really messing with him, and he made an outburst in class. "Who is bothering you?" the teacher asked. Peter Pan pointed to me and said, "Larry McKelvey, the big nose idiot." When he said that, I thought to myself, damn, even the special kids are calling me Big Nose. This is out of control. Between my abusive babysitter and those taunts, I probably should have developed a serious hang-up about my nose as an adult, but I didn't. Sure, the comments stung, but I can't say they gave me a real complex. I credit that to a couple of factors. The first is that, as I grew older, I realized there's nothing you can really do about a big nose. You can wear a hat if you have a funny head, or grow a beard if your chin's weak. Short of plastic surgery, which isn't an option when you live in a trailer on a dirt road and eat free lunches at school, you're pretty much stuck with the nose God gave you. So at a young age, I learned the power of acceptance. I had to accept that I had a big nose and just keep it moving. Plus, there were some big nose rappers popping at the time, like KRS-One, who should have called himself Nostrils Reign Supreme Over Everyone, or Humpty Hump, who spit the classic bars, "I get laid by the ladies, you know I'm in charge, both how I'm living and my nose is large." It also helped that, growing up around my cousins and friends in Mount's Corner, I was forced to develop a pretty thick skin and learn how to laugh at myself. As brutal as we could be toward other kids, we were even crueler toward each other. Nothing, and I mean nothing, was off limits. If your mother was having an affair, that was fair game. Father strung out on crack, fair game. Your uncle is living out of a van because he's lost his job, fair game. Your sister's baby has Down syndrome, we had jokes for that too. There were a million examples of how hard we went at each other, but two still stand out vividly to me. One was the morning my cousin Kwame's dog got hit by a car. We were all hanging out at the school bus stop when it happened. Kwame ran out to the highway, dropped to his knees, and did everything he could to comfort his best friend. When we saw Kwame weeping over his dying dog, did we go over and console him? At least tell him we were sorry his dog had just gotten run over in front of his eyes? Of course not. Instead, we started laughing our asses off. Yo, did you see how that nigga ran out there? Like, that shit was in slow motion, someone screamed. Another yelled, yo, that nigga acting like someone fucked his girl. What is wrong with him? As Kwame walked off with his dead dog in his arms, we were still rolling around on the ground, laughing and holding our sides. There was never a moment when someone said, yo, chill, that's not cool. We literally had no chill. Another time, I was watching TV with my pops and cousins, and the news came on that the actor John Ritter had died. Three's Company was a popular show in our house, so did my dad have a good word for the man? Hell no. He needed to die, offered my pops. Living in that house with those two women and ain't never fucked nothing? What was wrong with him? That's just how I went growing up. Nothing was off limits. Nothing was sacred or inappropriate. Everything could be turned into a joke. Black and ugly as ever. As I grew older, one person who inspired me to stay positive and ignore the haters was the late, great, Notorious B.I.G., especially his line in the remix for One More Chance, where he spit, heartthrob never, black and ugly as ever. However, I stay coogee down to the socks. It was only a couple bars, but for a black kid getting used to hearing he was ugly, those lines were empowering. The greatest MC in the game admitting to being ugly while refusing to admit that it mattered gave me true confidence. When Jay-Z started popping, he became another role model for the cosmetically challenged. Like Biggie, Jay knew he wasn't the best-looking individual, yet his charisma and confidence overshadowed what he lacked in looks. You can say he looks like a camel, but he's got the hottest chick in the game wearing his chain, so don't tell me God isn't real. Guys like Biggie and Jay taught me that as long as you focused on the however, instead of the ugly as ever, you could still be attractive to people. I couldn't control my height, the color of my skin, or how big my nose was growing, but I could control my aura. I could control walking into a room with confidence, no matter what was being said about me. I'm always motivated by people who own being black and ugly as ever. Take Eric Williams, the former NBA player who was on Basketball Wives for a few seasons. Who's more cosmetically challenged than him? Not only is he ugly, but he's got a huge keloid on his forehead that makes him look like a black unicorn. When he came on The Breakfast Club, I had to fire off some jokes on him. First, I put up a poll on our website asking listeners to vote on which one of us was better looking. For the record, I won. After teasing him about the poll results, I told him, man, you look like Hellboy. That's fine with me. Hellboy making money, Eric shot back. Who else you want me to look like? Someone got to play that ugly position. I'll take it. I asked him why he never gotten the keloid shaved off. I wondered because I'd grown a very similar bump on my forehead after Darnell beat me up in high school. I told the doctor to shave mine off. I wasn't trying to be bunky nose and bunky head. Eric explained that he'd gotten his back when he was a teenager selling drugs in Newark. Someone stabbed him in his head while trying to rob his stash. The bump grew out of that wound, and he could have taken it off, especially after he made millions in the NBA, but he never did. It's a constant reminder for me of how I grew up when I was young and dumb, Eric said. Even though you can't control your height, your skin color, or sometimes even your weight, you can always control how you come off to other people. Someone might meet you and think ugly as ever, but you can make that impression fade after a few minutes. Someone who wrote you off initially can leave a conversation with you thinking, that dude is cool, or that girl is funny, or that dude is smart. Not, that dude is ugly, that girl is fat, or that dude has a small mountain on his head. That's why if you're feeling ugly, and most of us do sometimes, always ask yourself, what's my however? If you don't feel like it's your personality, it's got to be something else. Maybe you're a great musician. Then let the world hear your music. You might be a great artist. Then let the world see your art. You might be a great cook. Then let the world eat your food. Maybe you enjoy working out in the gym and staying in shape. Then let the world be impressed by how ripped you are. Whoever you are, you can have a however. If it's already there, then let it shine. If it's not, get to work on developing it. Remember, Biggie didn't sit there in his mom's crib feeling sorry for himself because he was a fat, dark-skinned kid with a lazy eye and an AWOL father. He hit those Brooklyn streets and developed a bunch of howevers. Chances are, you don't have it any worse than Biggie did. So get to work on your howevers, too. The 8 Mile Theory. Another rapper who helped me understand the power in living my truth was Eminem. His whole career has been built on raw honesty. But one moment in his semi-biopic, 8 Mile in particular, has always stuck with me. M's character, Rabbit, is about to go on stage and battle Anthony Mackie's character, Papa Doc. Rabbit knows that Papa Doc will likely try to diss him on several fronts. Rabbit is white trash, his friends are losers, and Papa Doc's crew has already beat him up and had sex with his girl. Exactly the type of revelations that would normally get you crushed in a rap battle. So what does Rabbit do? Instead of letting Papa Doc use those facts to take him down, when it's Rabbit's turn to rap, he gets out in front of the situation and disses himself first. I know everything he's gonna say against me. I am white. I am a fucking bum. I do live in a trailer with my mom. My boy Future is an Uncle Tom. As soon as Rabbit dissed himself, he'd won the battle. He'd taken all of Papa Doc's ammunition before he even had an opportunity to let off a shot. Similar to Rabbit's strategy in that scene, I believe you should put your flaws and insecurities out there for the world to see before anyone can even try to hold them against you. It takes courage to proactively reveal your flaws to the world, but if you can find that confidence, you'll always be one step ahead of your opponent. You can never be embarrassed or discredited about something if you share it with the world first. If you would not be laughed at, be the first to laugh at yourself. Benjamin Franklin. That's why before you can get a joke off on me, I'm always going to clown myself first. I've known I look like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle since the first movie came out. I've even dubbed myself, the rappers Jadakiss and Jeezy, and the singer Neo, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Because the four of us really do look so much like Leonardo, Donatello, Michelangelo, and Raphael. We need our own movie on BET. So no one is going to be able to use that diss against me. There's very little that someone can reveal about me that's going to make me lose my cool or get me off my game. For instance, what's the worst thing you can say about a guy? He's got a small dick? Guess what? I've already talked about the fact I don't have the biggest penis in the world on air. So what sort of damage is that diss really going to inflict on me? Now, for the record, my penis isn't that small. I once got a little concerned about some of my competition, so I took out the tape measure like all men have, whether they want to admit it or not, and checked out how I measured up. The verdict was that I'm 7 3/4 inches in the winter and 8 inches in the summer, plus 2.5 very respectable inches of girth, no matter what the season. So while I had been concerned I was on the small side, now I would argue that, in fact, my penis is decent sized, or as I recently tweeted, not too big, not too small, it's like the baby bear's porridge, just right. God, Jewel. Fellas, always put it out there that you have a smaller penis than you actually do. If you tell a woman about how your dick ain't that big, how you're just average, she'll like that you're humble and comfortable in your own skin. She might let you get in her bed because she thinks she's doing you a favor. But then when you finally pull it out, you're going to surprise her in a good way for once. Women are so used to having dudes brag about how big they are, but then fail to measure up in the moment of truth. When you do the opposite, you'll be a breath of fresh air. And if you have had the misfortune of being born with a pint-sized penis, might as well be honest and let her know ahead of time. If she still lets you hit, then you can be comfortable and know she really likes you. Still, just by even suggesting that I didn't have the biggest dick in the world, I'd given myself so much power. The majority of black men in America would be ashamed to walk up to the counter of a drugstore holding anything other than a pack of Magnums. They happen to fit me very well, especially someone in hip-hop. So to even joke about having an average-sized penis makes me seem confident and secure. Not long ago, the comedian Cat Williams tried to take me down during one of his shows by calling me Charlemagne the Dog. Man, I almost felt sorry for him. I've been seeing that one since they invented social media. Whenever someone wants to diss me, they'll always try to flip the God part of my name. If it's not Charlemagne the Dog, it's Charlemagne the Broad or the Fraud. Some of the best Twitter slander directed at me. Charlemagne's cheeks look like dried up eye black. Charlemagne looks like a seahorse with diabetes. Charlemagne looks like he just got out of a chimney. Draymond Green's penis looks like Charlemagne's before and after pictures. I got a dark-skinned friend that looks like Charlemagne. I got a light-skinned friend that looks like Charlemagne. That nigga Charlemagne really looks like Jerome wearing Morris Day's makeup. Penis size, bleaching, being ugly. No matter how much someone slanders me, I'm gonna laugh. I'd be a hypocrite otherwise. Lord knows how many jokes I've made about other people's shortcomings. I said Drake looked like a thumb with eyebrows. I told Natalie Nunn from the Bad Girls Club reality show she looked like the McDonald's character Mac the Knight. I told Lil Mama if her face was the Bible, it would be the Old Testament. I said Adele is shaped like a Twitter egg. I told Ed Sheeran he looks like Jar Jar Binks. I even slandered the living legend Stevie Wonder, saying he looked like Jeezy from the front and 2 Chainz walking away. How the hell could I possibly get upset that a comedian called me the dog or said I looked like a bruised eggplant? It's all jokes, and I'm going to laugh at them whether they're coming at me or from me. I don't respect anybody who can't poke fun at themselves if they also go at other people. To me, that's a sign of weakness. I pride myself on being strong. One of the reasons I respect Bobby Bones so much is because he fully embraces the 8 Mile theory. Despite being from Arkansas, Bobby is kind of an outsider in the country music world. He didn't really grow up in the culture, and a lot of people resent him for that. But instead of getting uptight about it, he's completely open about not being fully accepted. People will tweet him about being a fraud or a poser, and he'll read their comments on air. He doesn't hide from that perception. He addresses it head on. A couple years ago, he played a clip of the emergency broadcast signal during a bit, which accidentally triggered the real thing. It was a huge deal in the radio industry, and iHeart ended up having to pay a $1 million fine. Most people would have tried to throw their producer or an underling under the bus, but Bobby fully owned the situation. He got props from me for that. The dude isn't trying to be anyone but himself. He's blind in one eye, so when it was time to name his production company, he called it Right Side Blind. I love that. Laugh loudly, laugh often, and most important, laugh at yourself. Chelsea Handler. Another person who employs the 8 Mile theory is the comedian Andrew Schultz, my friend and co-host on The Brilliant Idiots. Though he's never fessed up to it, Andrew clearly has a stomach condition. If you know Andrew, then I know what you're thinking right now. He's full of shit. Well, I'm no doctor, but he has to have irritable bowel syndrome. I've literally never been anywhere with this guy when he hasn't had to take a shit. Middle of a podcast, he's dipping out to take a shit. At a fancy restaurant for my birthday dinner, he's taking a shit. 6-hour flight from New York to LA, he's definitely taking a shit. Maybe two. This guy's bowels aren't irritable. They're downright cantankerous. Now, here's the thing. Most people would be extremely embarrassed and uptight about having a condition like that. Whenever it was time to take a dump in public, they'd be sneakier than Bill Cosby serving you a drink. Personally, I hate it when people know I'm about to shit. If I get that feeling, I'll try to hold it until I get home. Andrew is the exact opposite. We could be in a room full of people, and he'll calmly and loudly announce, "Okay, I'm going to take a shit. I'll be back in a few." Then he'll look around for a newspaper or a book and proudly waltz to the bathroom. Taking a stinky shit in public is probably near the top of the list of things people will make fun of you for, but by embracing the 8 Mile theory, Andrew has made himself immune to slander. It's amazing. Nobody can laugh about him or make snarky comments about him because there's zero shame in his shitting game. Think about how much stress and negative energy he's avoiding because he's honest about his nonstop need to number two. Irritable bowels, boonky noses, big-ass bumps, blind eyes, cosmetic challenges. We've all got that one thing or even a few things that the world might perceive to be flaws. It's inevitable. The key, as DJ Khaled would say, is not wasting your energy trying to cover them up. If you're uptight about something, the best thing you can do is be completely candid about what's bothering you. Try it. Pick something that you've always been self-conscious or guarded about and start sharing it with the world. If it's physical, show it. If it's emotional, share it. I'm confident you'll see that, far from making jokes at your expense, people will be sympathetic, even supportive. And most important, you're taking all the power out of it. At the end of the day, everyone respects honesty. When you free yourself of all the insecurity and anxiety that's been weighing you down, you'll be shocked at how high you can soar. Can I get a drop? If you search on the internet, besides folks accusing me of bleaching, I get clowned the most about the time I got punched in the head on camera outside of Powers Studios. It's another great example of why you should always live your truth no matter the situation. For many years, the dominant hip-hop station in New York City was Hot 97. Led by radio personalities and DJs like Angie Martinez, Funkmaster Flex, and Ed Lover. Then Power 105 and The Breakfast Club came along. And suddenly, Hot's grip on the city wasn't so tight anymore. The personalities at Hot felt threatened, especially Funkmaster Flex, who had been at the station since it switched to hip-hop in the early 90s. Around the same time The Breakfast Club started dominating the morning drive, Hot's longtime DJ and Flex's good friend, Mr. C, was revealed to be a serial purchaser of penis. By that, I mean C was arrested 3 times for soliciting transgender prostitutes. Before I go any further, I want to be clear, rival or not, Mr. C is a hip-hop legend. From starting as Big Daddy Kane's DJ to helping Biggie get his first record deal to his work at Hot, C is absolutely a part of hip-hop history. Nothing or no one can ever take that away from him. Unfortunately, instead of owning his actions, C tried to deny it. Every time he got busted, he tried to say it was just a misunderstanding. When that didn't work, he tried to insinuate that The Breakfast Club was creating the rumors, as if we could make up police reports in an effort to defame him. Flex picked up on that theme and delivered a very aggressive rant toward me over the air. "You are soft," Flex said in a theatrical voice. "You are baby bottom doo-doo soft, man." In addition to questioning my toughness, Flex also called me out for not spending enough time outside of Manhattan. "You don't go to the boroughs. You sneak in and out like a baboon when you're washing Carmelo Anthony and Lala's underwear. You run out to the laundromat, go back inside. Shut up, man. Out of town, fried chicken eating. I bet you know all types of chicken, right? Lemon chicken, soy chicken. One of those type of dudes, right?" I guess Flex was referring to a time I appeared on Lala's reality show. For the record, I've never washed Carmelo in Lala's underwear. I'm sure they have maids who do that. And while I do enjoy lemon chicken, I'm not really a fan of soy. "You're soft. Cakes, man. I heard that little shot you threw this morning. Is that what you want? Is that what you want?" That's exactly what I wanted. Now, if I'm being honest, I'd been hoping that Flex would come at me like that for a long time. I simply couldn't wait to catch that body. Like, see, Flex is an undisputed hip-hop legend, but over the years, he developed a habit of talking way too much trash about other people without being honest about his own situations, which meant he was fair game. So I let Flex have it. I gave him Donkey of the Day and then blessed him with the nickname, which has stuck to this day, Flex Hogan, since he sounded like Hulk Hogan when he would go on his rants. Then I added a little extra fuel to the fire by releasing a video called "What If Funkmaster Flex Told the Truth?" In the animated clip, I pondered whether Flex would ever talk about his domestic violence charges or the time he got beat up by DJ SNS for talking smack or the time some thugs allegedly stuck a pistol in his mouth for dissing Tupac almost 15 years after Pac had been killed. I'm sure he didn't appreciate the video one bit, but everything in it was true as far as I knew it. I don't know if there's a connection, but the Monday after that video aired, I was walking into work around 5 a.m. when I was approached by a dude with a camera. He asked if he could get a drop from me. For those of you who don't know, drop is shorthand for a name drop. Back when DVDs were still a thing, drops were a way for struggling rappers to look like they were hanging out with popular personalities. An artist or DJ would look into someone's camera and say, "Yo, this is Charlamagne Tha God, and you are now watching us sneak up on niggas and hit them on camera.com, or something like that. I gave those guys their drop, but something about the exchange didn't feel right to me. Who the hell is hustling at 5 a.m. for a Skreet DVD? I smelled a setup. I was so suspicious that later that morning on The Breakfast Club, I talked about the situation for our daily feature question of the day. I even asked, "If you get attacked on camera, do you fight or run?" Fast forward to the next morning. Once again, I'm walking to the station, solo, at 5 a.m., and once again, a guy approaches me with a camera. What happened next has been viewed over a million times on Worldstar. First, the guy asks, "What's good, my G? Can I get a drop?" In the video, you'll see that as soon as he says that, I could tell the bullshit was brewing. "What's up with y'all in these drops, man?" I asked, my spider senses tingling. The cameraman doesn't answer me, but repeats this time with a little more force in his voice, "I need a drop, son." While he was saying it, another geriatric goon that was with him snuck up behind me and landed a sucker punch to the side of my head. "God, you, always be wary when someone over 40 calls you son, unless it's your own father." Now, when you get punched in the back of the head unexpectedly, your fight or flight instinct immediately kicks in. In this case, I chose flight. I listened to my brain's command and started to remove myself from the situation. I backpedaled into the street and started to jog away, but had to sidestep a car that was headed straight at me. Once I got around the car, I saw the dude that hit me, the cameraman and two other senior sluggers headed toward me. I kept moving backward, Madden agility on 99, and did a half jog, half run until I was safely inside the power building. As a tax-paying, law-abiding citizen with a child, I handled that situation exactly the right way. How you should do, too, if you find yourself in a similar situation. I have zero shame saying that. Why would I stand my ground and try to fight four complete strangers? I didn't know what those guys had planned for me if they'd caught me, and I wasn't about to find out. A little while after this incident, I got tried again when I went to get some money out of the ATM in a Manhattan pharmacy. Some guy who was about 6'3 and 250 attacked me the moment I walked through the door. I don't know who sent this person, and maybe I was supposed to be intimidated by his size, but to be frank, I beat the shit out this guy with a pair of brass knuckles I had on me, just like my pops had back in Monk's Corner. I left him laid out on the floor, then I called the police and filed a report to have him arrested, because that's what you do when you're a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen of America and someone attacks you for no reason. Since I always owned my truth, as soon as I escaped into the building, I went on the Breakfast Club and shared exactly what happened with our listeners. That's the key point. When someone jumps you and you run, it's tempting to retell a story in a way that's sympathetic to your cause. They exaggerate how tough those goons were, or to skip over the part where you almost got hit by a car. I didn't do any of that. I told my listeners the undiluted truth. Four old-ass goons, looking like they could have been extras in a Spike Lee joint, had punched me in the head and tried to jump me on camera, and I'd hauled ass, period. A couple days later, the goons, or more likely whoever sent them, finally released a video on WorldStar, complete with a produced intro and subtitles. The internet poured over it like a Kardashian sex tape, looking for inaccuracies in my account. Ultimately, they had no choice but to say, damn, it went down exactly the way Charlamagne said it did. The incident had been set up to clown me, but I'd flipped it in my favor because I'd owned my truth. Don't get it twisted. It could have been bad for me if I hadn't gone on air and told people exactly what happened. Flex could have buried me with that video. If I'd gone on air and embellished how I reacted, he'd have caught me in a lie. Even worse, if I'd never spoken on the situation and tried to front like it hadn't happened at all, that would have hurt me. It would have looked like I was embarrassed about what happened. My credibility would have been shot. Instead, by owning my truth, I turned a potentially negative situation into one of my greatest moments. First off, over 1 million people have laughed at that video. Why shouldn't they? Some old dude smacked me in the head, and I backpedaled like an NFL cornerback dropping in the coverage against Tom Brady. It was funny. I would have laughed at it, too. Whether people were laughing with me or at me doesn't matter to me. I just appreciate them sending energy my way. Second, I truly believe there was an educational aspect to that video. Hopefully it helped folks see that you don't have to win every situation you find yourself in. Sometimes you got to give people today so you can have tomorrow. Imagine if I had stood my ground and fought. Maybe I would have caught one or two of them in the face, but then what? What if they broke my jaw and left me unable to do my job? Why even risk escalating the energy to that level? I'd much rather escape than find out. I'll always let goons win the moment if it means protecting my future. My future is so much brighter than anything a bunch of hired goons have to look forward to. God, Jewel. For those that fly may fight again, which he can never do that slain. That's the British poet Samuel Butler explaining in the 19th century was still true today. Running away when outnumbered is always your best tactical choice. While that incident ended up having a positive effect on my career, sadly it didn't turn out as positive for everyone involved. A couple of years ago, I got word that the dude who hit me was shot and killed in Delaware. I don't know his name, don't know where he was from or anything about him. I was just told how it ended for him. I can't say that it surprised me. If a guy will get up at 5 a.m. to punch somebody in the head on camera, then imagine what else he would do. He probably was into all kinds of dirt, and that energy finally caught up to him. Like my father said, when you live that life, you're going to wind up one of three ways. Of the industry or of the people. Growing up in Monk's Corner, I used to listen to the jocks conduct interviews on the radio and wonder why they didn't really seem to have an opinion. Why didn't they ever ask the obvious question when they had the chance? Which is why from the moment I got on the air at jams in Charleston, whether it was music, celebrities, movies, sports, sex, or politics, I called it like I saw it. Even if that honesty cost me a job, I refused to cut back on my candor. As my career progressed, I kept hearing the same refrain. Man, Charlamagne's so honest. The dude is so real. I appreciated the compliment, but I couldn't help but think, why am I being applauded for telling the truth? Shouldn't everyone do that? I came to understand that honesty is a rare commodity in the music industry. Part of that is the artist's fault. They've created a very toxic environment for the truth to flourish. As far as I can tell, hip-hop is the only culture where saying you don't like an album or didn't enjoy a performance are literal fighting words. Siskel and Ebert might have given a movie 2 thumbs down, but no one was threatening to shoot up their cause. Simon Cowell could tell a guy he was a lousy singer, but the dude and his team weren't trying to see him in the street afterward. When the Rolling Stones got embroiled in a lawsuit over royalties, which they have, I'm sure Mick Jagger doesn't go on a radio station with his goons and tell the label heads they're beefing with they're going to drop a refrigerator on their heads off a 12-story building. Salute to my guy, Jadakiss. The consequences for talking about a story are simply having an opinion, and hip-hop culture become too real. Think about it. When Birdman infamously rolled into the Breakfast Club with a bunch of goons and warned Envy, Angela, and me to put some respect on his name, what exactly had been our crime? Only that we talked about how he has a long history of allegedly not paying his artists, including Lil Wayne? A man who we saw kiss on the mouth, which we talked about too? It's not like we'd revealed some dark industry secret. Birdman's label, Cash Money Records, has literally been sued more than 10 times by artists claiming they hadn't been paid properly. Of course we were going to talk about it. That's our job, or at least it should be, which is why I told Birdman, don't act tough with the radio guy. At the end of the day, we're only there to give our opinion. If you don't like that, then address the issues we're talking about, not us. When artists and their teams try to intimidate personalities for having opinions, all it does is shut down open discussion and make for boring radio. Personally, I'm always going to state my opinion no matter the perceived consequences. Most on-air personalities won't, though. They'd rather play it safe than deal with some goons for saying they didn't like a song. Having said that, I can't place the blame solely on the artists. Another reason too many radio jocks and writers don't share their true opinions is because they're more concerned with making friends in the industry than being advocates for their audiences. Wendy was the first person who broke down this phenomenon to me. Every time you get on this microphone, you have a fundamental choice, she once told me. You're either going to be of the industry or you're going to be of the people. She went on to explain that if you're representing the people, then you will give your honest opinions on situations instead of the politically correct stance. When you're of the people, you will ask the questions that the fans want to hear instead of the talking points the publicists would prefer you stick to. If you choose to be of the industry, you'll always support the narrative that the record label is trying to push. When you're of the industry, you'll hype every album like it's a masterpiece, even if you couldn't make it past the first track. Most jocks end up choosing the industry. They want to be invited to the listening sessions, the album release parties, or the label exec's birthday party in the back rooms of fancy restaurants. They can't be of the people because they think if they ask too many uncomfortable questions, then the publicist won't bring them A-list artists anymore, so they play it safe. Wendy gave zero fucks about being safe, which I loved. Wendy and I are both cancers, and we share an instinctual need to speak our minds. I always understood why she was so fearless about asking tough questions and didn't spend a second fretting about the consequences. She couldn't do it any other way, nor can I. Wendy didn't care about being on the scene. You never saw pictures of her popping bottles in the clubs with rappers or dining downtown with executives. Her idea of a good time was smoking with Kev and chilling out at home. I know because whenever I'd hang out with them, we'd just knock back a couple bottles of champagne in their crib and I'd pass out in their purple painted guest bedroom. That was it. Wendy's attitude didn't discriminate. I even felt it when I first started co-hosting her show. When I say her audience hated me at first, man, they really hated me. They didn't like my accent, they didn't like my looks, and they especially didn't like that I had the audacity to walk off a dirt road in Monk's Corner and stroll into the Big Apple, freely stating strong opinions. Did Wendy try to cover up the outrage? Did she try to protect her young protege from the slander being slung his way? Hell no. She threw me in the deep end and then stepped back and watched to see if I could swim. If someone wanted to slander me, she'd put them on the air and let them go off on me live. She even put a poll up on her website asking whether she should keep me on or send me back down south. Something like 70% of the people said, nah, send that lisping motherfucker back home. The attacks were unrelenting. If you want a contemporary example, imagine Beyonce's beehive swarming against someone on social media. That's how Wendy's fans were coming for me. I wasn't sure I was going to survive.